Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Ashley Kopovich, regional director at CREXI, and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics for CRE newcomers and industry leaders alike. My name is Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director, and I'm joined here on the mic with Eli Randall, our Chief Operating Officer here at CREXI.
Thank you, Ashley. Eli, welcome. Thank you very much.
Of course, of course. And today we are thrilled to sit down with Glenn Konofsky, founder and CEO of NNN Pro Group. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Glenn Konofsky is the founder and CEO of NNN Pro Group, the market-leading net lease brokerage team in the country. Since its inception over 20 years ago, Glenn and his team have closed over $30 billion in transactions across more than 10,000 properties with over $5.6 billion completed this past year. Glenn has a long track record of working with some of the nation's largest institutional real estate companies, including publicly traded REITs, private equity funds, hedge funds, high net worth individuals, family offices, and developers. His vast knowledge and expertise structuring sale leaseback programs and brokering, acquiring, managing, and advising on some of the most complex transactions across retail, office, and industrial properties has made him the leader in the commercial real estate industry. Glenn currently resides in New York City with his wife and two children. He's involved in several organizations outside of the office, including YPO, the Adaptive Sports Foundation, Arizona State University, and the Victor Green Foundation. Glenn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Of course, we're so excited to sit down with you. So I know that we just got covered a long range about your background, but I'd love to briefly dive in and tell us a little bit more about you. So where do you come from? What did you do to get into commercial real estate? Give all our listeners a background about you.
So I grew up in Rockland County, which is about 20 miles north of where we sit. I would say people call it a suburb, but when I grew up there, it was pretty rural. Both my parents were not in real estate, both teachers and then assistant principals and principals of school here in New York. So watch them commute in every day. And that's sort of where I grew up.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit then, if we didn't have the influence from the parents of being in commercial real estate, which a lot of our folks do, how did you get started in commercial real estate? What drew you to it?
You know, it's sort of a weird progression of how I got into commercial real estate. One of the things I remember growing up as a kid when my grandparents actually lived in the city, and my dad used to drive around and be like, he was a teacher and didn't really have the entrepreneurial spirit, but he always, like, I remember going back a long time and we would drive around and he said, oh, I dated a girl one time and her dad owned that building and I could have bought this building for, you know, $200,000 and now it's probably worth $2 million, but he never really had the entrepreneurial or probably the capital as well. But how I got into sort of real estate in general, whether you want to call it commercial or residential, I bought my first investment property when I was a freshman in college. This was during the savings and loan crisis or sort of the end of it coming out. And we actually were living in a student housing complex. I had some roommates and there's a lot of rules about like when you could have people over to, how late you could have parties. So we wanted to get out of there. So we went out with a realtor to try and find the house to rent so we could have bigger parties and have more people and no rules.
Man, after my own heart.
And the realtor basically said, you can buy a house if you have $2,500 to put down and you assume a mortgage. And I had worked the summer before, and my buddy who was looking at things, I said, why don't we split it? We'll go half and half. You come up with $1,250, I'll come up with the $1,250. The day of the closing, my friend said, hey, you know, I don't have the money. I asked my dad to borrow the other $1,250 from like my bar mitzvah money that I had. He gave me the money. I bought the house, and then I had six roommates that moved in, and I basically lived for free and got some money to live on. And that was my start in real estate at 18.
So Ashley knows I can't resist asking every guest, was there an alternative career path either available, or in hindsight, you say, you know what, I could have gone down that road?
No, I mean, I really had a lack. I was, you know, if you talk about someone who's like, I always just had this desire to be an entrepreneur. From, I had businesses as a kid, from, you know, shoveling driveways and, you know, washing people's cars and mowing people's lawns. I always had a desire to be independent and have my own money. And my goal wasn't really focused on an industry. Like, I love people that have I have 19-year-old twins today. And I said, my kids are now spread out over the country. I'm an empty nester. But I think back to like how I was when I was that age versus how my kids are today. But my desire was always to be completely independent and make a living for myself. So it wasn't targeted toward, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be in real estate. It was like, what is the path? And looking at different people of how, you know, they got to their success, and figuring out, I had all kinds of different businesses over, even like from the real estate business when I started in college, and then I was a helper for a construction company doing tile work. And I got exposure to different people, for builders, developers, contractors, and all of it. I was always like, who's the most successful? What where do I want to go that's going to drive independence and success?
I love that. Eli and I were just talking about that, and being independent and making your own money. I think sales is an awesome way to be able to do that, really get out what you put into the work. And that's why I love sales, to be honest. But definitely in commercial real estate, that's a big, big key factor. Now, in commercial real estate, you do want to be specialized, know exactly what asset you're in sometimes, right? And really hone into it. So what was attractive to you about triple net leases? How did you get your experience there, and how did you figure out that's what you wanted to do?
So sort of backing up just a little step, I like when I got into commercial real estate, I was in business for myself basically for 10 years out of college. I grew the rental portfolio. I had 27 properties while I was in school. I would buy these properties, fix them up, lease them out, and get cash flow. And then after school, I further developed and started buying more multifamily type real estate. And this wasn't 300 unit apartment complexes. This was duplexes, fourplexes. I think the biggest property I owned was 18 units. So I spent basically 10 years doing that. I met my wife in college. My wife had much more of a professional path. She went to school for accounting. She became a CPA. She worked for KPMG. And I was running around doing all my own stuff. I had these rental properties, I had a construction company. I had my car dealer's license. I would go to auctions and buy cars and put them at my properties and try and sell them. But basically, long story short, she came home one day after basically 10 years with KPMG and said, you know, we're going to, you know, we always talked about moving back to the East Coast. I put in for a transfer. They granted me a transfer to the New York office. Are you coming or not coming? So I was sort of forced into this decision a little bit. And I had dealt with some of the commercial multifamily brokers in Phoenix. And when I made that transition, I came back. I had a year to go back and forth to consult with people who bought my construction company. I met a broker that was working. He actually opened the offices for Marcus & Millichap in New York. And I met him, and this is before the time of where you did an online course to get your real estate license. So while I was going back and forth, I met a gentleman in this class, and you spend 7 days, 8 hours a day going to a class to get your real estate license. And I really didn't know what I was going to do at that point in time. And I told him what my background was, and he said he had worked for this firm, and there was two other firms to talk to that he thought would be a good fit for me. And that's sort of, I started interviewing with real estate firms, and it drew me in of, I'd never worked for anyone basically my whole life. And to your point, saying like, where could I go put my skills to work, but not have to answer to a boss? And that's how I sort of fell into it, originally getting into commercial real estate.
Okay. Anything to add there?
No, I know you were getting there. Any mentors along the way, any people who helped guide you? I know you seem very independent and entrepreneurial, but I'm sure some people helped nudge you down the path a little bit.
Yeah, I think I have some personal mentors, you know, in my life. You know, like I said, my parents weren't big into, you know, business. They encouraged me to get a union job with benefits and be a teacher, a garbage man, a janitor. That's what they thought was the safe path in life. And then I had my uncle was much more of an entrepreneur. So I had a little bit of that rich dad, poor dad sort of guidance. And then as I learned in business, you know, the beauty of commercial real estate. And also while I had my construction company in Arizona, I met a gentleman, his name was Ed Rapay, who I still keep in touch with today, but we would do the flooring in a lot of his commercial and retail buildings. And as a client, and this has sort of guided me through my whole career, is he would say to me, I was like, oh man, how'd you get this building? And he's like, Glenn, buy real estate. I moved from Milwaukee. I was in insurance sales, but real estate appreciates, real estate creates cash flow, real estate creates opportunities. And that sort of stuck with me as I was, you know, our crews were doing this floor and I was doing all this. And I was like, man, I want to be the guy who owns this building or can be on a higher playing field. And my uncle always encouraged me. He said, like, everybody works hard. It's really the playing field that you're on. And the, you know, with brokerage and commercial brokerage, there was unlimited earning potential. And getting also, there's two things, you know, unlimited learning responsibility. It was your success was up to yourself. And then the ability to get to meet highly successful people that have, you know, a lot of people in the real estate industry, there's a decent amount of inherited wealth, but a lot of the people and companies we deal with are self-made people in a lot of different industries. And that exposure, and I don't like saying that now, but like the exposure to the clients and the opportunities really guided me and mentored me to be able to sit with someone that's highly successful in what they're doing and get to spend time and pick their brain. It was always how I grew. I learned a lot more about, you know, business from those experiences than anything I ever got out of school.
For sure. I agree with that wholeheartedly. So what are some of the lessons that you learned? Elaborate for us, maybe early on, middle of your career, even now. Give us a little bit of taste about the hardest hitting lessons you've learned.
So, and this is different than a lot of people in commercial real estate. And it's sort of why I got into triple nets. Going back to your question was, even when I was buying these homes, you know, this didn't come from school or even asking people. Like, I had a very simple model. What would I buy it for? What was the payment? And what was the cash flow after expenses? So really the biggest mistakes I've ever made, there was a couple early in that residential piece of buying things for appreciation. And, you know, sitting in New York, a lot of the investors come from this mentality of, I'm going to buy something that's going to be worth more. That's really never how I thought about real estate. It was like what it could generate in terms of income. And that sort of guided me to triple net. But, you know, the biggest mistakes I made, I think, along the way were buying things for future appreciation. And I know that's different than a lot of people view real estate. My vision was always like, what was I going to pay? What was the payment? And what was I making? And that's how I viewed it.
That makes a lot of sense. So moving into today and our second topic here, let's talk about NNN Pro and the established brand you've built in the world of triple nets. So to provide some context, why don't you tell our listeners, what is NNN Pro? How did you get started and where the company is today?
Sure. So, I started my career when I made that shift. I became a broker at Marcus & Millichap. Hadn't worked anywhere else before, and I made that choice to go there. Initially, I was thrown into, you had a degree in hotel restaurant management. You should be our Northeast hotel specialist. And I spent about a year doing that, and the transactions were very difficult in terms of you're basically acting like a unsophisticated investment banker of trying to shuffle through what expenses are and what actually cash flow is. Got a little exposure relative to some of the meetings about the triple net industry really wasn't established at this time, late 99, early 2000. There was only a few institutional REITs, and it really wasn't an asset class like it is today, where private investors, institutional investors do. So I got drawn into that, really looked at it and said, this is a more simple property type where you take away the expense underwriting and really your rent is your cash flow. The whole definition of triple net is the tenant is taking all the expenses out of the equation, and what the rent is net, net, net to the investor. So that appealed to me. I didn't want to have to be doing all this analysis around what the actual cash flow was. So started there and basically found some success, and the institutional market was dominant. There was really two or three REITs that were buying net lease properties. We started in the restaurant industry, and we saw a lot of these REITs buying at very high cap rates. When I was sitting at Marcus, one of the REITs had listed a bunch of the properties and they were presenting them. And I said, wow, this is a great property type. The rent is the rent. And so I started going after these restaurant companies that were selling to these institutional clients. And I basically said to myself, we can get you better terms, because I knew REIT was hiring the company to sell these properties. And my first ask to the companies was, well, what did you sell this to REIT for? And they said, we sold, for $1 million at a 10 cap. And I was like, well, look, 6 months later, we're selling them, for $1.2 million at an 8 cap. Why wouldn't you just hire us to sell them, for $200,000 more? And that's how the business evolved. And I basically started the group by going to a lot of franchise companies like Burger King, Panera Bread, all these chains that were selling to the REITs, and saying, we can get you better terms, we can get you better pricing, and developing programs for those clients. And, a lot of those clients are still clients today of NNN Pro. And as we grew the team, we had our own division, and I went from having just one assistant to then two or three people that joined me for the association, and then three or four or five or six. And, today we sit at about 100 people, and we've since spun the company out to be independent. But the way that we started was really, our culture over relationships, over transactions, and gaining these relationships and doing right by the clients. And that's basically been how we built the business from the start to the finish today. And over time, we've lost very few clients, and we've just grown. And now we've expanded into so many different industries where real estate and triple net real estate is a use for corporate businesses. A lot of people don't understand where the product is generated from, but it's really users of the real estate that don't want to own real estate. And we're an alternative financing source. So today we sit, it's a very specialized practice. We only do triple net leased properties. We're industry specific to mostly, we do a lot of multi-unit retail. We do a lot of industrial, but it's all based on triple net leases. A high percentage of that is sale leaseback and servicing corporate clients and institutional clients in the space.
And you highlight some of the appeal to sellers and your clients. What would you say the key feature is for buyers, maybe specifically private investors? What's the paramount feature of a net lease investment from their perspective?
Well, it's interesting. The benefits of a net lease investment compared to a lot of other commercial real estate investments is the lack of day-to-day management. And I don't like to promote triple nets the way certain people do. Of it's mailbox money. You just get, there are things you have to do and manage. It's just not as intense as a lot of other property types. So it started, you know, for the private investors, of educating them of why buy a triple net lease, you know, versus owning an apartment building or a shopping center or a multifamily where every day you have to hire management. You have to, and I lived that world. I had these units and every day someone's calling, my toilet's clogged, the roof is leaking, something is happening. So educating private investors that they could own and have exposure to real estate. And I've always said this, like a lot of that it's really a fourth asset class. And there's so few people that deal with real estate from like a banking perspective. And that's more of what we do than just sell real estate. I think we're going to talk a little bit about brokerage later, but being an advisor to those private investors and putting them at ease when they're spending a lot of money moving from one commercial real estate type to another. But the big benefit of triple net leases is the lack of day-to-day management, the fact that the tenant is doing most of that, and the fact that you can get exposure to real estate without having to have a whole management team or spend time yourself on a daily basis.
Glenn, that was a great overview, I think. Getting into a lot of what we were talking about, and we'll go over this in more depth about your client relationships and how you grew, you know, NNN Pro and how do you keep the culture and all the tenants. We'll get to that. But what separates NNN Pro from the rest of the other firms that are out there? So I think you talked maybe about relationships versus transactions. Highlight a little bit about what separates you guys from the rest.
So I think one of the things that our goal was of when building the team and the culture is relationships generate everything. And most commercial real estate firms, and this went back to, you know, big leasing firms, you know, big companies, of everything they teach their brokers is transactional related. How to go in and pitch for the listing, how to get the highest fee, how to... And I never agreed with that philosophy. I was always I want to gain the relationship with that person and basically be their advisor for life, whether that be a company, whether it be a private individual, and become their advisor. So the success and the growth and trying to mentor all our people into that same philosophy of being the opposite of what most commercial and residential real estate is, of everyone's about closing the deal and getting it done and ringing the bell. And I made this, like, that's not how we've, you know, measure our success. It's measured by how long a client is with the firm, how many times you transact with them. But the goal is putting the client first and putting the relationship first. And we really have built a culture that's the opposite of most commercial real estate firms. Like, and the cycle, and what I always like sort of looked at is the cycle of commercial real estate is mostly long-term ownership. So if I meet you today and you own five buildings, you know, it may not be for 2 or 3 or 4 years that you decide to either buy a new investment property or make, but I want to make that relationship and I want to. And so we have really, the core guiding principles are being more knowledgeable than our competition about the product that we're doing, working harder than anybody else on it, and putting the relationship over any potential transaction. And that's sort of the motto. We haven't spent a ton of money on branding and marketing, and we're coming out with all that in the future. But really, without having had to do any of that, I hate to say it, but it's been word of mouth, recommendations, do right by people, and the business comes.
I love the very client-centric approach. I think it's spot on. We've heard that about you. And I think for the audience members who aren't in retail or net lease, you know, you're a pioneer in the space. It's hard to ignore the sheer volume of transactions. Nonetheless, how do you preserve the thrill of the deal, especially when it's often homogenous products. You know, a Burger King may look very much like one you sold a year prior. You know, what keeps you going and fighting on behalf of that client?
You know, I think it's our people that, like, it's 100% our people. And sitting as CEO is very different than, I don't do day-to-day brokerage anymore. My job is more so running the company, keeping our culture, assisting our brokers to keep with our core principles, and keeping people grounded relative to what their purpose is. And the transactions come, the volume comes through. We have tons of qualified people with the same philosophy. And at our company, we really also, like, we spend a lot of time collaborating with each other, which is the opposite also of a lot of commercial real estate firms. Like, you know, and, you know, I had experience a long term at Marcus, but I also, a lot of people that we have that have joined us have come from other big firms, and not to knock the competition, but in all these places, essentially the guy sitting in the cube or the office next to you is essentially your competition. One of the things that we set up at the firm is a very collaborative culture, and we talk about clients' issues, clients' problems, property problems, financing problems as a group, and collaborate to find solutions together. And we're very much not competing with each other for clients, for properties. And, you know, my job as the CEO is to preserve that culture. And it's very difficult in terms of recruiting new people in that have come from a culture that's like that. So we've been very careful, and we continue to be very careful relative to someone being a cultural fit. And as we think about, you know, recruiting brokers that are successful in other firms in the triple net industry, like, we're really trying to guide our principals not by the dollar or the transaction volume that someone does. There's plenty of people that are killers out there. They're transaction related. They go, they pitch, they get a listing, they close, and then they never do business with that client again. So my job is really to preserve that culture, preserve our mission, vision, values, and that's what I'm spending most of my time on. And we're finding, you know, I think we'll talk about a little later, but in the tougher markets when there's dislocation, that's where we shine.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's extremely impressive what you all have done over the past year. I think looking at the statistics, it's $5.6 billion across 1,200 lease transactions, which is amazing. And I'm sure kind of led you to recently spin off the company. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. So you are officially a new, your own brokerage firm as NNN Pro. Talk to us about what's next. What are the visions for the future?
Well, it's really exciting. I mean, I say to people, we're like a 25-year startup. We announced the separation, but we essentially had this culture and core group for much longer before. But the biggest and most exciting issue for me is to that we're not part of something else. Our culture, our relationships are what we are. So what's next? You know, I would say, you know, being associated with a big firm, we didn't have, you know, to deal with our own marketing and other things like that, even though we're independent. We've made a lot of investments in technology and marketing, and we want to grow strategically with the right people. And, you know, we think the opportunity to be, and I think already we're the leader in the space in terms of the volume of the transactions that we do, that is a solely net lease focused platform. But we have big plans for growth across the country. And more so just gaining more market share, more relationships, and continuing to be a leader in the space as a company.
You're talking a lot about growth and preserving culture, and that's very important to myself and Eli. Obviously, it's one of our biggest tenants at Crexy. So talk to me a little bit, and I'm sure this is applicable for our listeners. What do you look for in that hiring process, and then how do you maintain that culture when you are growing?
It's an ever-evolving process. Most of the team and our successful brokers have long-standing tenure with us. I think, you know, we have people from 17 years to 15 years. You know, the difference, like what I saw in commercial real estate, is brokers pop from firm to firm. We've been benefiting from that. And so as we look to grow, we want people to be with us for the right reasons, to be part of a collaborative culture. And it has been very difficult as the CEO to look and go and meet with other successful people in the space and trying to understand how they would fit in with the existing team. But there's a lot of good people out there. We're spending a lot of time with them. And I don't think you can measure somebody on stats. And that's the hardest thing for me. I look at you and I say, oh, you did 100 transactions this year and you generated $5 million. That would be great for you to join our team, but that's not the metric that we're looking for. Do you fit in with the others? Are you going to be a toxic person? Are you going to be like basically finding the fits of specialization, both geographic, property type, client type, and how does it mix with the rest of the people that we have?
So that was a great primer for what you look for going in with a potential employee. In hindsight, what have you found to be the common attributes of, you know, some of the standouts? What do they all seem to embody, if there are commonalities?
I think commonality with us is work ethic, really. I feel like we have both the best technology, the best way to think about the product, and knowledge of the product. But I feel like work ethic, just as an example, one of the things that we do that should be a standard in net lease and any commercial real estate is we see every property we sell. Someone on our team goes out. If you're committed to hire us, we're going to go see that property. We're going to understand that property. We're going to know it just as good as the owner knows it. That's not the norm in net lease. I can't tell you how many firms just want to, you know, send someone out to take pictures, snap things off of Google, and not understand the property. But work ethic, like, it's difficult with the amount of volume that we do and the amount of volume that each individual broker does. It's hard because, you know, institutional owners routinely hire us to sell portfolios. And you may have 20 properties in 20 different states. The easy thing is just, all right, well, get someone to take some pictures and see it. You know, we go out, we see it, we spend the money to do it. But secondarily, it's we routinely have people in the office till midnight, till 1 a.m., 2 a.m. When there's a pitch or there's something that has to be done, our people's work ethic is really important. And the culture today of a lot of people, that doesn't work, you know, for us. But I think our work ethic, our grit, that's what makes someone successful at our firm. And that's what makes someone fit in, going above and beyond and working harder than the competition.
I find that amazing. I think you have a national product type. In many ways, you're selling a financial instrument or a lease. And I think it's great you guys stay really in tune and close to the real estate. That's important.
Another thing that you mentioned, Glenn, is talking about the technology. So elaborate that on that a little bit. What technology does the team use? How is that advantageous in your business?
Well, we love Crexie. I mean, that's, you know, technology is like, I mean, you guys have the best technology. I think in addition, like, we spent a lot of money and time on developing our internal process and software, CRM, and it's ever evolving of what that can do. And that's an ongoing effort. I think a lot, like the blend between keeping up with modern day technology and then keeping that focus on the client and the property. And that was sort of what I was alluding to. Like, you can avoid going to a property today. Like, you can go online and get a picture of anything almost anywhere today. So that's great. We still go back to the old school. But, you know, we've employed like a lot of, you know, we've used so many different types of technology to measure sales at property, using tax records, ownership records to develop. And there's a lot of great tools out there, almost too many. But, you know, the main things that I'm most proud of relative to our technology, and we're spending a lot of money updating this today, is basically relationship management technology to our CRM. We're really proud of how to stay in touch with that client and make sure that as individual brokers grow and our firm grows, we keep in touch and we produce data and stay close to the client. That's the most important part to me. But, you know, when I started, you know, a CRM was a Rolodex on your on your desk, and you just made sure, who did I not call today? But I think, like, and this isn't just to flatter you guys, but Crexie, as opposed to some other things with an interface that's smart, that you can search, that you can do, we have our own internal, and then using your service to sort of guide and get information out of in real time and get real information. We monitor our own comps and in different industries and sales and everything. And we do, and we're using a lot of technology to better serve our clients, especially in an ever evolving market where, you know, as a perfect example, comps from last year mean nothing with five real estate, you know, with interest rates being 500 basis points higher. You can't measure it by that, but we're making a lot of investments, and we think that blend of technology and human touch is really important.
Glenn, kind of touching on that, interest rates and, you know, all of that rising, give us a little insight into what you're seeing on inflation, rising interest rates in the triple net space, and what do you predict will be the long-term rollout of these trends?
So interest rate rises, like in my sort of long career now, it's unprecedented. We haven't seen interest rates raise this fast, this quickly. So some of that really hasn't sunk in yet. I believe as a firm and as an advisory firm, as we view ourselves, there's a few things. So obviously cap rates lag interest rates, and every commercial real estate transaction is gauged upon what the cost of debt and equity is. So we're in a period right now where it's starting to creep in, and the gap between buyers and sellers is wider. Sellers want the cap rate and the price from last year. Buyers want what makes sense for their debt today. So it's definitely creating a slowing of transactions. As a company, the benefit for us on that is people want the best advisor today than any advisor. And it was easy. When you have 5 years of very constant interest rates and cap rates, people look and say, hey, I can hire anyone to sell this property, and I'm going to get a relatively, you know, same result. Today, they're looking for better advice. They're looking for people who are going to get deeper into it. But the market as a whole, I see there's going to be cap rate adjustment over the next few months. I think the institutional market reacts much quicker than the private market. So we're seeing institutions, both buyers and sellers, you know, adjusting much quicker. The private market is much slower to recognize, you know, my property's worth less. And if I want to sell, I may lose money. But, you know, as an advisor explaining, okay, you might lose money on this transaction, but you're going to invest at a higher rate. And then it goes back to the relationship and being an advisor. The other positive thing is the net lease industry has evolved. When I started, there's maybe two public REITs specializing in net lease. Now there's maybe 20. There's a lot of private equity, big family office. And, you know, our job, and I'd like to be proud of being a part of it, is that the private investor market drives a lot of these transactions today. So it's an asset class that's not going away, that people want to invest in, and that ultimately it's going to grow. Interest rates and cap rates are always going to move. We just got in a period of time where everything was easy. Cap rates are going to go up. Expectations of buyers and sellers will adjust accordingly over time.
Are you seeing any changes in store sales to the extent that some of the customers report them? Are you seeing shifts there?
I think, the pandemic had a big effect relative to boosting some industries and then hurting some others. And I think some of what we're seeing today, I mean, obviously, quick service restaurants and things with a drive-through and things with delivery did very well during the pandemic. And then there's a shift now for people wanting to get out and use experiential real estate. So those things coming up. I haven't seen really the pressure on the consumer and sales as much. I've seen just shifts between industries, but and then more so on the corporate side, you know, labor shortages and increases, supply chain issues have more affected a lot of our corporate clients than sort of top line and sales, other than shifting of trends where, you know, like I said, quick service in the restaurant industry was up. And now you're seeing a lot of casual and experiential people wanting to get out and socialize and be together. More so, but I haven't seen much
pressure. And what seems to be the darling right now? Is it QSR or some other segment?
In terms of investing or how they're doing?
In terms of perhaps, well, both performance and then also buyer demand.
So I think in the net lease industry, one of the, there's a, on the institutional side, it's much more of like what you were talking about, how these tenants and businesses are doing and much more financial analysis related to the business and the real estate. So, you know, we represent a lot of private equity and a lot of businesses in niche industries that use real estate that, you know, some are very stable, some are not. We do a lot, you know, this is sort of, you don't see, I think we invented the sale leaseback in the funeral home space. So can't really decide when people are going to die or not die. Unfortunately, that's a factor of life. But as a net lease investment, can't stop people from dying.
Yeah.
So, like, it becomes interesting. We go into a lot of niche industries like that, amusement parks, golf courses, a lot of different things that these companies use real estate. So explaining to both the institutional and private investor why this is a good business and why it's a good investment. But in the private market, you see a lot of people relate to things that they know, right?
If Starbucks.
Yes. If you go to Starbucks every day and you see a Starbucks is for sale, that's a very easy investment for a private investor to understand. They understand the product. They understand the business. They can go to any corner in America and see people driving up and doing this. But I think that remains, QSR is always a very stable thing because people use it. They understand it. They're located in very similar type markets. But what I would say is in the market today, the most high demand things with the best credit that we're selling at the lowest cap rate are actually some of the hardest deals to do today. Using example of whether you use McDonald's or Chick-fil-A, the things that were the lowest cap rates, things that were trading in the threes and fours, it's now very difficult to get that cap rate, especially as you get up in price. In the sort of under $2 million price class, you still get buyers that are all cash or mostly all equity to do those, and it's not affecting finance. If you get into 4, 5, 6, 10, $20 million, it's certainly going to be financed by partially bank financing. So financing a 4 cap at 6.5% interest rate doesn't work. So it's actually what's going on is we're seeing a lot of demand in lesser credits in different businesses so investors can get a return based on the current interest rate environment. So that's a lot of where we play. We play in the investment grade arena, but we play in a lot of the net lease, specialty as well.
So we can move on from the nuts and bolts shortly, but I'm curious what's the minimum term that's deemed financeable market cap rate deal? At what threshold do you start, putting some premiums on the cap rate and changing your value perception?
I think we're in an interesting time. Like what I was saying before, cap rates lag interest rates. So in the smaller transaction types, you know, we're still closing very low cap rate deals and demand, you know, in that QSR space, in the Dollar General space, in the even like the bank branch space. And there's still a hangover of demand, a lot from 1031 that people sold 6 months ago, and the cap rates haven't really adjusted in bulk. So we're still seeing very low cap rates. We're starting to see volume come down a little bit. There being lesser 1031s. I think once you get above the $3 or $4 million category, it's really driven by interest rates. And in those transactions, there's a bigger slowdown right now because they require financing. And then everything that's happened over the last few weeks with regional banks and the pressure and the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the FDIC looking at all these regional banks, commercial real estate, unfortunately, has become like a bad word. So that's also putting pressure on slowing transactions because the regional banks are the bulk of who finances all commercial real estate, and they finance net lease a lot. So finding the right mix of things, both not only just rates, but the demand based on how you can finance a transaction. But I think it's all going to, like, I think the first half of the year is still going to be slow and shaky. I think as everyone sort of adjusts to what a stable market is going to be, we're going to see much higher volume in the second half of the year, and we're going to see cap rates adjust up.
What advice would you give either to maybe younger brokers or investors who are trying to ride out this market shift right now?
What I would say is brokerage as a whole is a long-term game. Like I was saying before, putting the hard sell on someone relative to trying to meet the market today is not the right approach, right? If someone doesn't have pressure to make a transaction one way or another, giving them honest advice of like, maybe it's not the right time to sell. And that doesn't come out of commercial brokers' mouths very often, which is better than saying, oh yes, we'll get you a 4 cap or a 5 cap. And then it doesn't happen. That's where you lose clientele. But my advice, and this goes across, you know, other industries as well, you want an honest opinion, you need patience, and things will adjust appropriately. And you just have to be patient and value that relationship versus getting something done today.
Absolutely. It goes back to what you were saying before, the relationships over the transaction and giving that honest feedback or what people are going to remember you by and want to work with you. So I love that bit of advice. Going on into a fourth topic here. So given your specialized background, we have a few rapid fire questions to ask you if you're okay with that.
Sounds good.
So our first one, if you were given $10 million today to invest immediately, what would you do? What were the options be? Where would you invest it? What location? Give our listeners all of it.
I have a lot of personal exposure to net lease real estate and commercial. So I would more so in terms of investing in real estate, I still like good core real estate that is generating. So I really like different smaller middle markets around the country. Like people come into us all the time and I know you want a rapid answer, but basically, you know, I measure the principles of where a tenant wants to be long-term and what's going to be a long-term investment. I think it's very difficult to buy in super prime markets today because the cap rates haven't adjusted as much. I would go to more middle markets, middle market tenants that are paying a good return that equal a good cash on cash return.
Great. Right. Yeah. Rapid answer not required, I guess. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, they're just rapid worry. Questions.
It's just rapid fire questions.
As you've seen, I tend to ramble on a little bit. So
no, not at all. Perfect. Not
it's
at all.
All good stuff.
So I always like this question because I like to eat a lot. You have a national platform. Let's say you close a phenomenal deal with a client you really like. What's the ideal closing dinner, or more so, where is the ideal closing dinner?
You know, for me, it's funny. We deal with a lot of chain companies all over the country, and they're our clients, and I love them to death. So, but I like finding unique experiences in local markets, and you know, the fact that it is a relationship business, I like to ask the same question: if the client is in St. Louis or Kansas City, where's the best restaurant in town? What's the local favorite that we could go to? You know, we've had I'm trying to think of the New York staples that we go to, but we try and like, if the clients are here locally, there's a lot of great places. We like trying all the new places and different places versus going to older staples. I'm trying to think of what, you know, we recently did a team event and, we did ABC Kitchen. That's always fun here.
Cool.
In the city. That's a good one. I'm drawing a blank on some of the other funny ones. Like, I used to get to pick all the time. We now have a team and an events team that's coordinating and doing a lot of these things, which has actually been better because I'll go back to the same standards, and now we're trying a lot of new places. It's a lot of fun.
Fair enough.
We just asked this to our VP of auctions as well. Where would he go as a closing dinner? And he had the exact same answer. He said, I'm going to ask the client, and they're going
to
tell me.
Appropriate answer, but I'll defer to the client. So I got to reshape that question.
That's the relationship. You and I might like sushi, but if they don't, that's not, it goes back to the relationship.
Eli Good and point. I are just trying to find out where to go to dinner tonight. No, just kidding. What is, and I promise this isn't a trick question, what is your favorite tool to use on the job?
Favorite tool to use on the job? Let me think.
Technology, platform, CRM. What do you guys use most that promotes the business, makes it run more efficiently, effectively?
I think it goes into, the tool of technology is less than the tool of understanding the buyer's or seller's goal and their whole portfolio. And again, this isn't it's not a canned answer. Like, you can't get, the technology isn't going to get you what the investor's goal is, right? Like, understanding the situation and where the property sits. So I really like to get deeper into the client situation. It's very easy if it's a publicly traded REIT or something like that, using the tools of hey, they're trying to figure out a pie chart of what industries and geographic like this, so they could say, hey, we want to be here. And then we can plug into Craxi and say, what's for sale in New Jersey or what's in North Carolina? But especially when it comes to private clients, a lot of, the people deal with commercial real estate on a property by property basis, but it's still amazing to me that when you're dealing with an investment advisor with stocks and bonds, they look at your whole portfolio. What stocks do you own? What industries do you own in? A lot of brokers don't ask about, okay, how much money do you have in real estate? What's your risk profile for this versus something else? And, the tools of really examining the person's financial and exposure to other commercial real estate, and dividing that's really, and then, devising a plan on their overall portfolio and then doing the analysis and using the tools and their risks, whether it's a net lease portfolio, a shopping center portfolio, say, okay, this is the best investment for you because of the other things you have going on in your life. And it's also very different by age, by, a lot of people are investing money for trusts for their children and, asking people simple questions like, if you die, who's going to manage this real estate? Like, so can you do a 5-year lease versus a 15-year lease? If you're an 89-year-old person and you're investing in real estate and you're still active, A lot of people don't say, you know, okay, hey, buy this short-term lease because you could reposition it. If you're going to have no one to do it, how are you going to handle that?
Mm-hmm. I took away from that answer, and Eli, feel free to chime in, but I took away that almost your most valuable tool is your team, right? And the questions that you instill within your team. Obviously you have 100 folks, a lot of top talent, obviously a great training program. So without getting too much into the secret sauce, but a follow-up question, is there a program or is there a set of questions that you do have your team ask to get out this information? Because a lot of brokers will just, you know, kind of mull over it or not ask those type of questions. So is there something within the program that you go through with each individual agent?
We have a lot of tools relative to the analysis of each property, both demographically. We use tools like Placer to sort of measure sales and productivity. A lot of it comes in, we have these collaborative weekly meetings, and our chief of staff runs a meeting, you know, buy side need, sell side need, interesting situations to get everyone's take. As much as I'd like to say that I'm the smartest guy in triple net real estate, I learn from my team every day. And if you have, you know, 100 people, you know, 25, 40 in the room, people dialing in on Zoom, someone saying, oh, I have this client and they have this property and here's this issue in the lease. Has anybody seen this before? That's where we get a lot of answers to the complex questions.
I took away a different answer.
Okay.
Your cell phone. So you can ask your client a lot of questions and also communicate with your team.
That's a great tool.
That's what I interpreted from that. But, kids, you said you have two kids. Would you welcome them in the industry? I don't know their ages. Perhaps they're already doing other things. But is this an industry you would encourage them to get into?
You know, I have twins that are 19. They're in their freshman year of college.
Same school?
No, schools? They're very different.
Where are they going, if you don't mind me?
I have my son is going to Reed out in Portland, Oregon. Cool. And my daughter is in Emory in Atlanta. They're very different. Besides being male-female twins, they're just different interests, different experiences. But the one, my daughter is much more business and finance focused. That's where she wants to major. That's what she wants to be in. My son is a math major with a music minor, very into quantitative math that I have no understanding of.
It sounds as if your son may have your wife's mind and your daughter may have your mind.
A little bit. Or personality, one or the
All
other.
Right. Like, okay.
I love music. I love listening to music, going to concerts. I have not a musical talent in my body, unfortunately. He is an amazing musician, too. But what's interesting is he's interning for us this summer, and he's really excited about it and wants to learn about it because I think it's the opposite of what he's dealing with in school. I would welcome both into it, but I want them to pursue their own passions. I don't want to force them down a path. But, you know, I love the industry for me. It's created huge opportunities beyond what I ever thought it would be, but I want them to drive their own path. If they want to come in, that would be great.
Cool. Yeah. So I'm going to steal one just because you mentioned music. One of my questions is, what's a recent either band or artist you dusted off and said, damn, this is good.
I'm a big classic rock fan. I went to a lot of Grateful Dead concerts. I did a lot of tours, a lot of the jam bands, the Allman Brothers. It's funny today, I'm starting to get into newer music, partially like riding around with your kids for the last 10 years and sort of understanding like what they're listening to. Some of it you hated. I just was recently in Aspen. We saw a band called Mountjoy, a newer band. They were actually really good. It was a lot of fun.
Cool. Great.
Love hearing that. But back to the industry, Eli, love the music questions.
Anything to avoid real estate all day. Just kidding.
One last real estate question. What is the most common misconception either about your job or about the commercial real estate industry in general?
I'll go back to the same answers. I've answered almost everything. Unfortunately, it's like everybody thinks real estate's transactional. I really think it's long term, it's driven. Like everybody thinks, like how many deals did you do this week? How many deals did you do? Like I don't measure it in that. I mean, it's great to be in the CEO of the company, and I'm proud that we do this as many transactions as we do. But like, the misconception is that I think people say, you know, you get rich by doing transactions. You really don't. You get rich by building the relationships. You get rich by repeat clients. If me and every one of our brokers had to go and pitch a new client each time, why hire us? And you know, I've been doing a lot more recruiting and a lot more mentoring. You know, we have a mentoring culture, but this get rich quick mentality of why someone comes into commercial real estate to do big deals, to make big checks. Like, you know, our base is actually relatively small transactions and adding them up together. So I think that's the biggest misconception. Like, I have people come in and brokers, and they say to me, you know, how much am I going to make in year one? How much am I going to make in year two? How am I, like, it's like, no, how many relationships are you going to gain? It's going to take you a long time to build it up. And you know, I think that's the biggest, you know, there's low barriers to entry into commercial real estate as a whole. You know, most people can go and get a real estate license in almost any state in a week, in a day, take an online course, and they think they're going to get rich quick. That's just not the case. And I think that's the biggest misconception of the real estate industry as a whole. Like, you're riding in a car with someone, you meet someone, they say, what do you do? Say, I'm in commercial real estate. Say, oh, I have my real estate license and I'm doing this. Like, unless you're specialized, gain relationships and do it, I think that's the way to success.
That was very well said.
Yeah.
Very well said. So, Glenn, you've given us a lot of advice, a lot of things for our listeners to take away. Any last bit of parting wisdom or anything that you want to share with our listeners today?
You know, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you and spend time. What I would say is stick with it. This is a hard time. People really don't know what's going to happen relative to rates, to the market, to, you know, pressure on tenants that you talk about. And I think it's, you know, what I would say is the biggest thing is hire the best advisor you can. Come see us or anyone in our company. And, you know, the opportunities actually and wealth comes from times like this and being able to invest when everyone is going somewhere else.
Well, there you have it. Well, thank you so much, Glenn, for taking the time to sit down with us today. Anything else you'd have to add?
No. Thank you, Glenn. Appreciate it.
It's been absolutely wonderful. If our listeners want to get in touch, how can they get in touch with you? Social media, Instagram?
We're on Instagram. We have the official NNN Pro on Instagram. We have, I'm on Twitter. The company is on Twitter. I think it's at Glenn Kanofsky on Twitter. Our website is nnnpro.com. And, you know, come find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app. Or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/Crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.